Hey, podcast listeners, welcome to this week's rerun encore edition of the podcast. Today's guest is Harold Batiste, and we'll get to that in just a minute. A couple things I want to tell you. One, the first thing is, I don't know if you got a chance to listen to Mark Maron's interview with President Barack Obama on his podcast, WTF. It was fantastic. Just a great conversation. I really enjoyed it on a million levels. And it kind of reminded me, somebody was criticizing my interview with last week with author Cherie Homer. And I thought, you know, I enjoyed it partly because I just enjoy hearing any two people talk. I want to hear people's stories, even if they're not famous or if they're not full of drama, etc. Really, last week, just for her Wisconsin accent alone, that for me, that was worth it. But so if you're a fan of conversations or the content, check out this interview with Barack Obama. It was really fascinating, unlike anything I've heard. I want to remind you also, there's some great interviews coming up. Johnny Farina, who was half of Santo and Johnny. They had a number one hit in 1959 with Sleepwalk. He'll be here. Rick Hall from Muscle Shoals, Alabama's Fame Studios will be here. He's written a new book. He's 83 years old. It's called The Man from Muscle Shoals, My Journey from Shame to Fame. And I've just started it, and boy, his life was poor. Can you hear my daughter's piano lesson upstairs? She's practicing piano. Maybe you can hear that. Author Wyndham Wallace, he's written a book about his relationship with Lee Hazelwood. And then finally, Kim Shattuck from one of my favorite bands, The Muffs, will be here. Their 1993 self-titled debut album is being re-released with bonus tracks, and we'll talk about that. So you can get the dates on all of those over at WFMU.org/Michael. Now, this is from 2009, Harold Batiste, big New Orleans music maker. Interesting story. He was one of these guys kind of hard to reach. Well, I'm going to stop talking and play you the original podcast introduction in which I sort of tell the story behind how this interview came to be. But as I was listening to it again this week, I thought, I'm not sure how much of this is true. He's kind of a slightly bitter guy. And so sometimes you never know. But it's an interesting, certainly an interesting story. And he passed away this week. And just another guy that whose story deserves to keep on being told. So this is from 2009. It's 6 years ago already. But here it is. You're going to hear the introduction from the original podcast and then my interview with Harold Batiste. So thanks for tuning in, folks, and I will talk to you soon. Welcome, podcast listeners. So I decided, I don't know, after like the 10th person canceled on me and I was left, you know, you play a half hour of somebody's music on the radio program, and then you call them at the number they're supposed to be at, and they're not there. And it's a terrible feeling. It's just the worst. So now I try to go to every effort I possibly can. And when I'm in doubt, like I was last night, I called Harold Batiste on the telephone because he had not answered my email. I contacted him by email. He's today's guest, by the way. He replied, and he said, sure, I'll be available. Here's the number. So a few days before, and I wrote back saying, great, I'll remind you a few days before. So a few days before, indeed, I send him an email, and he does not answer that email. So yesterday I call him, and I reach him, and he totally forgot about it and seemed a little bit muddled. Nevertheless, I said, oh, he said yes, he would be there tomorrow, 11:30 New York time. So I called him this morning, 11:30. Guess what? He wasn't there. I tried his cell phone. He wasn't there. Finally, about 15 minutes later, he calls the radio station back and says, who's this? I said, well, this is a radio station. You're supposed to have an interview. I said, oh, I guess he just hit his, you know, caller ID and called whoever it was. He's 78 years old. It's sort of hard to hear him. He's on his cell phone. You hear, like, trucks driving by in New Orleans. But it's a very interesting story, and he's kind of revealing and honest here. And I think it's pretty interesting. So if you're interested in the minutia of a guy who played on a lot of amazing records, and I urge you to check out the archive of the whole program at WFMU.org/Michael, because you can hear just about a half hour of great Harold Batiste-related music. If you can do that, check that out. So anyway, here is this interesting guy, Harold Batiste. I know. All right, it is just my luck. I believe I've got Harold Batiste on the telephone. Mr. Batiste, welcome to the radio. How are you?
Where are you?
We're in New Jersey, in lovely New Jersey. Where are you, in New Orleans?
Yeah.
And you're born in New Orleans in 1931, is that right?
Correct.
And tell us, when did music come into your life? When did you first pick up an instrument?
Oh, pick up an instrument. Well, I didn't pick up an instrument first. Well, I did, I guess, when I was playing with two forks on my mother's furniture. There was a radio came on, and it was with music, and that was give me two forks and stuff.
Two forks, and you'd ruin your mother's furniture?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you did study music at Dillard University, right?
Oh, yeah, that was long. That was way up. I started when I was in elementary school. I started practicing, and, you know, by the time I was at Dillard University, I had been in high school, and I had been in the band in high school.
And what kind of music was that, the high school band, playing?
High school band music, like football games and things like that. We did a concert. We'd do a concert every, at the end of the school year.
Gotcha. And did you think I might be a professional musician? Was that in your mind at that time?
It was beginning to be. I didn't think of it as a profession because my mother didn't want me to be a musician.
What did she want you to be?
A doctor.
That's what all mothers want, I think.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, but you stuck with the music, and was there a big demand for live music at that time around New Orleans?
Well, it was always, yes, there was always a big demand, but I didn't know that. I didn't associate music with making a living. I was caught between my love for music and my love for what my mother wanted me to do.
Yeah.
So we compromised when I finished high school and when I went to college and said, "Well, I'll go into music education, be a teacher." That was rather than be a musician. I'd be something decent. My mother thought being a teacher was more decent.
Yeah. So you had sort of a respectful job teaching music, so you could still do music. But at that time, you were still playing with lots of different bands, including Joe Jones's band, right?
Right. Yeah, I was playing when I got in college.
And you ended up producing "Talk Too Much," his giant hit, right? How did that come about?
Well, I was playing in this band, and when he got that song from a friend of his, we started playing it on the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And we could see that the people's response to it made it sound like a record that people would like. And so we asked a record man in New Orleans to let us use his studio to make this song. And that's how it came about.
And was that a record recorded completely live?
No, we went in the studio and did it.
But I mean, is there overdubs or is it just one take, the band's playing all together and he's singing?
Yeah.
So you played in a bunch of different bands, you were a music teacher, and finally you quit teaching out of frustration, I think, right? Just with the school system and the administration, et cetera?
Right, it was still during the segregation era. And I just couldn't deal with the way they were treating people in the black school. They were making the music supervisor was discouraging me from teaching how to read music. So anyway, it just was not a pleasant situation.
I'm sorry, they didn't want you to teach African-American students to read music, but they did want you to teach white kids to read? Is that right?
Well, I wasn't teaching any white kids because it was still an issue.
Right.
But that's where my resentment is at. Because I asked the superintendent, "Are you telling the teacher up at the white school not to teach the kids to read?"
Right.
I couldn't, and so I had to go for the school board and justify why I didn't want to follow the supervisors. So I said, no, well, they offered me an option to through that, or I could offer my resignation. So I quit.
Yeah. So you quit. And one of the things you did was you went out to L.A. to play with Ornette Coleman, right?
Yeah.
And at that time, Ornette Coleman was not a full-time musician, right?
No. No, he was. He was just, you know, he was working, he was driving an elevator.
He was an elevator operator. And how were those gigs? I mean, what did the music sound like at that time? That would be the mid-50s, right?
That was in, that was in 56, 57, something like that. Yeah, that's when I went on
television. And what did your band with Ornette Coleman sound like at that time?
Well, it didn't sound like much, because the gigs wasn't worth doing too much. So the main thing as far as the gig was, it was just a little once-a-week gig. We'd work at a little Mexican joint. But it was enough to keep me out there. And in the meantime, we were really working on trying to get something together in the studio.
Right. Trying to break into the... Now, you take a demo over to Bumps Blackwell, I believe.
Yeah, it was. That was just right. That was the thing. I went over to... Specialty Records, because I knew somebody there might know me. I was trying to make the rounds in Hollywood, but it wasn't easy to get into those record companies, you know, like Capitol and RCA and all those big companies.
But Specialty had a big New Orleans presence, so you thought you could...
And I thought somebody would recognize my name anyway. Baptiste is very, you know, well-known in New Orleans.
Right.
All the Bumps Blackwell, who was the A&R man there, he didn't know me, but he thought he knew me because my name was Baptiste. He knew I was from New Orleans.
Well, that worked. So you got in the door,
but I was trying to push on that Coleman thing, and Bumps wasn't interested in the right thing. He was busy. He was busy at the time preparing a session for Sam Cooke. And he asked me to help him with that. He said, "But you help me get this thing together, and I'll listen to your stuff." Simple as that.
And so that song was You Send Me, right? That's what you worked on.
That's what it turned out to be. He was looking for a B-side. He already had made up his mind what he wanted to record for Sam Cooke as an A-side. You know what an A-side is?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
The song they think will be the big hit.
Yeah.
And then they have a throwaway song for the B-side, and he was going to use You Send Me for the B-side?
Yeah. That's what it was. In fact, the next day when we were in the recording studio, we had finished the A-side, Summertime. And Bumps said, "Well, what did y'all come up with for a B-side?" And I had this little song. Sam had a little song he had written, and I just changed a couple of words in it. There wasn't many words in it. But it was just a B-side, so we did it, and they had four singers. That was the game bust. There were singers that they had hired for the A-side, and they didn't have any music for them. So I had to write music for them for this song.
The actual arrangement for the vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they couldn't do ad lib. They were, you know, they were professional singers and they were music. So I did that, and then we did about four or five takes of You Send Me. And in the meantime, the owner of the company, Aru, came in. And he heard what we were doing, and he got angry. He didn't like that. So he's got Sam Cooke sounding like a white boy up here.
Huh.
And so he fired the singers that I had, that we were hitting on, and he took over the session. So that ended for that day. And he didn't know me because, you know, I was there because of Bumps Blackwell. But
what happened? So you just started hanging around Specialty, and pretty soon after that...
The next day, he and Bumps had a run-in. He offered Bumps. He said, Bumps, if you think this is so good, you can have these tapes. And in lieu of the royalties, he owed Bumps back about $10,000. So he made Bumps that kind of offer.
He said, you can either take, you send me or the $10,000, and Bumps took the record?
Yeah, he took the tapes. He said, I'm going to take these tapes.
Wow.
And he went, Bumps immediately went to a friend of his who was starting a record company, that named Bob Keane. And so the record came out on Keane Records. And so now Art Rubin is left, especially with no A&R man and no record either. he called me up back down in New Orleans and said, man, we were in mourning here because after it broke open like it did. Well, first of all, they didn't expect you to send me was worth nothing.
Right.
So
he called you and asked you to run the New Orleans office, and at the same time, he asked Sonny Bono to run the Los Angeles office, right?
Yeah, well, see, Sonny used to come over there. Sonny used to drive a meat truck. You know, that was his job.
A meat delivery guy.
Yeah. Huh. He used to stop by special to try and hustle song.
Huh.
So that's how I got to meet Sonny.
That's your first meeting with him, and you would cross paths with him many times over the years. You immediately set to work. It was kind of the tail end for Specialty Records, but you did cut some great records with Jerry Byrne, like Lights Out and Art Neville, and Don and Dewey, some fantastic records. Was it natural to sort of, those are almost all, you know, a fuse between rock and roll and R&B.
I was new at it. I didn't know nothing about that because I didn't come out to Los Angeles to do that. I came out to Los Angeles to play jazz.
Right.
So it didn't matter to me whether it was rock, whatever y'all want to call it. I just focused on the material, the artist, you know, who brought me stuff.
But I mean, there's a big difference between Jerry Byrne and Art Neville, both talented guys. What was your attitude when Jerry Byrne walks in with Lights Out? Where did you think, I'm going to try to cut a hit?
Do you think that was a big difference?
Yeah, I don't know.
You tell me what was the big difference. I don't know what the difference was.
Well, Jerry Byrne has a little bit of more of a hillbilly approach.
You think Lights Out was a hillbilly song?
No, but it's a little... They both had that great New Orleans-y kind of shuffle to them.
Yeah. It was... Well, if I had to categorize it, I was just like it was an upbeat rock and roll record. That's all. It was just...
Yeah, I guess that's the case.
Upbeat, fast tempo rock and roll record. And Art Neville was playing the piano on it, and we just made it, you know... Affair. In my mind, I was thinking in terms of Elvis Presley. Not in a positive way, but in a way that was dealing with what I thought was going on in the market.
Yeah.
Because I realized that the word rock and roll was being opted because they opted rock and roll, and most people now have accepted that. But I came up in the black community, rock and roll. I mean, the first time I heard using that term was Joe Turner. You ever heard of Joe Turner?
Sure. Big Joe Turner.
Well, Joe Turner was rock and roll way before there was an Elvis Presley or whatever that guy out of Memphis was. Was it Walk Around or Clock?
No, Bill Haley, sure.
Bill Haley. Joe Turner had been doing that, and a lot of black cats have been doing that. And that's what I was concerned with. Frankly, I was concerned with the fact that there was another op taking over of music out of the black community and recycling it to the white community once they found out that white kids loved it. So I said, well, if they're going to play that game, Jerry Byrne will go over pretty big, and that was based on which my Andrew Brown was, and Mac, the cat who brought him to me was Mac Rebernick. Jerry Byrne used to sing with Mac Rebernick's band,
and I didn't. Huh? I said I didn't know that. So, what about John and Dewey? Farmer John is such a classic record. Yeah. And again, it's like partly an R&B record, you know, partly a rock and jumping record.
John and Dewey, first of all, it was a rare find in doing what they was doing, because Don was an accomplished violinist.
Yeah,
he could play, and he could play some jazz on the violin. Don could. I forgot which one of them it was, Don or Dewey. But they were more or less really entertainers, and they're the ones who, you know, who wanted to record and act crazy, you know. I mean, that was their thing. Yes, overlook music, you know.
So they were like a nightclub act, sort of.
Yeah. Don and Dewey, they were. They were, and there again, I'm telling you the same story. They were the prototype for what turned out to be the Righteous Brothers. Righteous Brothers used to want to do a Don and Dewey act, and that's what they based it on.
So you worked for Art Rupe at Specialty from about 57 to 59 or so, is that right?
Right. That's just about right.
And then you did You Talk Too Much with Joe Jones.
Yeah.
And that came out on Joe Ruffino's label.
Rick.
He had Rick and Ron. He's another sort of guy who was a legendary music character.
You know, there's a new book out called Record Breakers and Makers that deals with the whole history of independent records, like the old, like Chess Records and Aladdin,
right,
and all of those small independent companies. And Joe Ruffino was one of the New Orleans boys.
I mean, New Orleans is kind of, it's like its own country, you know?
It is.
And every book I've read about it, Dr. John's book is really interesting about growing up there and about the police and just, it seemed like a crazy place to do business.
It was a crazy book, but Mac is crazy.
Mac Rabinac is crazy. Well, that's good to know. I mean, was Joe Ruffino a guy who paid everyone with a statement every 6 months, or how did that work?
None of the independents, maybe Atlantic was the only one that. No, and there was a couple of them who really tried to do it legitimately, but most of them were just a bunch of cats who was like the dope stuff now. Back then, the independent record business was not a business. It was a hustle. it was just a hustle because the major record companies like Decca and RCA and the big companies that They were not paying attention to that was still called race music. I don't know, how old are you?
I'm 45 now.
Well, you might be too young to really know how that was back then. But
I was born in 64, so I've only read about it.
You sort of missed that. Because you had to be around in the 40s and 50s to understand.
So you talk too much. Well, that makes perfect sense. I think the same thing happened with movies, with all entertainment. They sort of ignored, the black community, and all these little guys sort of filled the void up, and there was a huge market.
When they moved into, a lot of them immigrated from, they were immigrants from a foreign country. A lot of them were recent immigrants, a lot of Italian guys. They were on the lower rung of the white community. And therefore, where they lived in more closer proximity to where blacks live. And they got to know what blacks like. They got to know the kind of things that, and they realized that money was being made selling records. They used to sell those records out of the trunk of their cars. They'd sell them at grocery stores. They would sell them at any place that they had a little sign up. They could sell some of those records.
Huh.
But RCA and the big companies that didn't even come in the neighborhood, they didn't know. So all those independent labels started like that, and they started dealing with people who didn't understand it, that they just wanted to make a record. They didn't know about money. Mm.
Was there contracts in those days, or did you just make the record on a handshake?
Either way, it doesn't matter. If a piece of paper didn't really mean that much.
It doesn't mean that much. So you never got any money for You Talk Too Much?
No.
Nothing. Yeah, that's amazing.
I didn't pay for the arrangement.
Yeah. You sent a copy of the record to Fidel Castro, right? Because at that time,
that was funny. Yeah.
And he didn't take offense, right? He was sort of charmed by the message You Talk Too Much.
I don't think they got it. They didn't
get it. But he sent you back a letter, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a part of somebody in office. They sent a letter back.
That's pretty funny. You went on the road trying to promote some stuff, and you wind up in New York City broke, and Lloyd Price helps you out, and I believe he introduces you to Maurice Levy at that point, right? The guy who runs Roulette Record, another guy, a well-known, eccentric record company owner.
Eccentric, that's the word you use for that.
What was he like? What was Maurice Levy like?
Well, I didn't deal that much directly with him.
Hmm.
See, because I was just a newcomer to the record business. I was dealing more with Lloyd Logan, who Lloyd Price is. Because Lloyd Price was now on Roulette Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Lloyd was rescued me and Joe because we were broke. But we didn't know that Joe had already recorded the song once for Roulette.
Mm.
And once we got there and Lloyd brought us over to Roulette, that's when I found out, maybe Joe already knew, that's when I found out that we had already recorded that song. Joe had already recorded that song once, but Roulette hadn't released it. It was sitting on it.
Mm.
And of course, by the time we got to New York, it was on the chart. And so it was between them and Dorothina then.
So this is now, we're talking about 1960, 1961. You finally get back to New Orleans and you say, I'm sick of being ripped off constantly. And you start AFO Records, All for One. It's mostly African-American guys that start the label together. And the idea is, if we're going to make these records, we should make the money as well. Why not, right?
That's right. That was the basic idea.
It sounds like a great idea. At that time, what was a session fee? How much was a regular fee if you played on a hit record? What would you get?
It didn't matter whether it was a hit or not.
Right. Have you played on any record?
I forgot, and I think it was about $41 or something like that.
About $41. Yeah, so it's not easy to make a great living doing that, and other people were getting rich on some of those records you guys were playing on.
Well, that's what I worked at. I did the math on that thing. I really, before that phrase was popular, I did the math, and I took an example of like a very popular saxophone player at that time was Lee Allen.
Lee Allen, sure. Walking with Mr. Lee.
Yeah. He used to play on all the Fats Domino's records and commissions. And I figured out if he got a 2-cent royalty. On whenever he on one record he could make about $10,000. He can make more than he makes in a year playing on record dates.
Yeah,
at $1. And I did the math and found out that, and that's what I proposed to the guys. I said, man, we make too many records, and to say that you get paid through a union, you get paid as a for hire worker. Which means you ain't gonna get no record, no money. You just get that salary that you paid then, and that's it.
Yeah.
Well, that.
Let me remind everybody, we're talking to Harold Batiste here, founder of AFO Records, and this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. You guys had a giant number 3 pop hit in 1961 with Barbara George's I Know. Great way to start off a company,
Right. Well,
Not bad. And you had arranged distribution with Juggy Murray up at Sue Records, and it sort of, for a minute there, it seemed like it was all going to go just like you planned, right?
Another crook.
What's that?
Say, another crook. Juggy Murray was another
crook. Juggy Murray, another crook. Yeah, but an African-American guy this time, right?
Yeah, he was a black guy. He wasn't
American. He was okay. He was a black guy. He ran Sue Records for years and years. And what happened? He just didn't want to pay you because you guys ended up doing Lee Dorsey's Ya-Ya.
You got to understand. Yeah, he was jealous because I had done Ya-Ya for Bobby Robinson. We had a record label up there too, in New York. And Bobby Robinson put his record out before he put I Know out. But he thought I should have brought Ya-Ya to him.
And is that really the reason why he ruined your relationship and all future hits that could come his way?
He ruined it because he thought he, I mean, from what I was hearing him tell people that, you know, these boys down here don't know what they're doing. And, you know, so I got to take, he wanted to take Barbara George. And he convinced Barbara, when he got Barbara, Melvin and I, who's my partner, when we heard that Barbara said she wanted to buy a contract from us, I said, something's wrong. Why does she want to buy a contract? But he had played the real crook game. She's only 19 years old. And she was pregnant. Had been living in the project all her life. And they just didn't understand, know what was happening. This happened too sudden for her. So, but Juggy Murray, and I shouldn't say all this on the radio.
Why not? It's the truth, right?
Yeah, but it's just what happened, man. He got her up there, and he bought her a Cadillac. Right.
And she never had another hit. She had a Cadillac, but she didn't have any more hits, did she?
He had a Cadillac and a fur coat that he bought. He didn't understand that was her money. He was buying her. So
did you guys ever get paid for Barbara George's I Know record?
No, not really, no.
No.
I mean, in fact, that's what sort of broke us up. Because not only did he not pay us, he had the government thinking that he had paid us.
Yeah.
So the government put a lien on all our stuff.
Oh, jeez.
And for taxes.
So you didn't? They were looking for taxes on money you never got paid. That's
right.
That's a dirty trick.
Are you telling me? he was right. We didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah.
He saw that we were just naive, you know, boys, young musicians trying to be.
Yeah, that's. So let's talk about Lee Dorsey. I had Alan Toussaint on here a few weeks ago, and he talked about what a great guy Lee Dorsey was and how much fun it was to just hang around with that guy. Was making Ya-Ya a fun experience?
The only reason I got to do that was because Toussaint was under contract to Joe Banaschek, and, you know, he would tell a record label. And Toussaint was supposed to be a part of AFO, but the same thing stopped him from being Barbara George. I played piano on the Barbara George record because Alan Toussaint couldn't do it. He was under contract with somebody else, so he couldn't be a part of what he was doing. But that, so the same situation happened with Lee Dorsey, so he called me up to play it on and do Lee's thing.
So you finally you wash your hands of this whole thing and you move back out to L.A. again. We're talking about 1963, right?
I forgot when it was.
Somewhere around there, 64, 65. And you hook back up with Sonny Bono, who's trying to get this thing going with his wife.
Right? I didn't hook back up with him. I hooked up with Sam again.
You hook up with Sam Cooke again?
Yeah.
Oh, and were you playing on those last Sam Cooke records then?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then how'd you hook back up with Sonny?
Well, he hooked back up with me when he met Cher.
Okay.
He was working for Phil Spector at the time.
For Phil Spector.
So I came back out there. Sonny was working, you know, working for Phil Spector.
And did you get some dates playing with Phil Spector?
Yeah, that's, well, he got his son told Phil Spector I was there, and they started hiring me to play piano, you know, on Phil Spector dates.
So which Phil Spector dates are you on?
Well, the Righteous Brothers. There's a couple of them on there. I didn't ever even see the Ronettes. I didn't know who they were.
And did Phil Spector pull a gun on you, or was he cool, or what was the situation like?
That was before his gun did. He hadn't started pulling a gun yet. But I saw him with that at that time too. But he was that was at the point where I didn't like his sessions because it took too long. It looked like he didn't. He would spend 4 days on the same song.
Yeah.
You know, but it seemed to me like he was either a genius doing stuff, or he was paranoid, scared that he didn't want to finish.
Hmm.
He didn't ever want to say, okay, yeah, that's it.
Just make a commitment and go with it.
So anyway, I don't know what it was. But he was sort of crazy anyway.
Yeah. You start playing with Sonny Cher and helping Sonny arrange and really produce some big hit records, like I Got You Babe and The Beat Goes On. And one of my favorites is Baby Don't Go. I love that record. Is that you playing the melodica on that song?
What a
catchy, you know, you don't hear melodica in a lot of top 40 records, you know?
Well, just like I Got Me, you don't hear oboe in them.
Yeah. So I Got You, Babe, is it your idea? Let's put an oboe in this song?
That's what I did, but I know. That's why I had a trumpet solo, a cornet solo on that record. Hmm. I wrote on that solo for that record.
Hmm.
Because all the rock and roll people were playing guitars and saxophones. So I'm a trumpet solo.
And did Sonny appreciate your contribution to those records, you think?
Did he? That's why he wouldn't let me go. When he got ready to do a television, but I must say this, Sonny had a confidence in me that I didn't have in myself.
Huh.
He really thought I was a genius.
And did he pay you?
Not much. He didn't pay me that much. You know, if you got to come, I compared what I knew they were making.
Yeah.
And there was no money. I mean, he didn't. If I had been like Jack Nitzsche,
arranger.
The writer who wrote about this in Cream magazine. So I had to have been a white arranger or producer. I would have known better.
Hmm.
See, I didn't know no better. And in my background, I didn't understand money, that kind of thing. I always didn't want to charge too much. I didn't want, you know, guys would get $400 and $500 for an arrangement, and I was still getting union scale.
Hmm.
You know, to understand that, you got to realize that my background, and that's the sick case of a lot of black cats, you're not exposed to what the white community is doing. You don't have those. I didn't have no parents to him who had a big time, nothing going. I never did get to understand what the value of money was.
I guess you learned the hard way.
Yeah, I just never did really make a lot of money. I thought I was making money. I thought I was doing all right.
You said that Sonny Bono thought you were a genius. What did you think of him in terms of his talent? Obviously, he had this drive to, you know, get off that meat truck and sell some songs. Was he a talented guy as well?
I don't know. Well, it depends on how you define it.
What do you think?
Well, I think... Well, first of all, he was a very smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was deceptively smart. He understood people very well. He knew how to talk with people and make them feel all right. That's how he got to be a senator or whatever he got to be.
Right.
Yeah. mean, because he, I always used to see him on the telephone with him as a promotion man. He was, he could really talk to people in such a way that would make them like him. And he understood that. That's why he understood that for Sonny and Cher to go, let Cher be the smart person, and he would be the joke. Oh, Sonny can't sing. Well, Sonny knew he couldn't sing. Huh. Who was going to the bank?
Interesting. Yes, Sonny was. You played on records by Jackie DeShannon and all kinds of people around L.A. And then 1967, I think, you hook back up with Mac Rebinac, who's sort of got this Dr. John idea. And you make a couple of great records with him. Just really amazing records that have a really unique sound to them.
See, now you hear, your radio audience is hearing all the bitter side of me. Because, Mac Rebinac was a young white boy, drug addict, all of his young life. Not all of his, but he was about 15, 16 years old. He was headed for nowhere but jail. But he was rescued two or three times from jail. Jerry Wexler would rescue him the biggest time and put him on methadone. Saved him. And, you know, that was after I had done Mac. And he wasn't even supposed to be Dr. John. Another cat named Ronnie Barron was supposed to be Dr. Barron. Dr. John.
And just Ronnie Barron couldn't do it, right? So they...
His manager would not let him do it.
There's some early Dr. John instrumental sides that came out on AFO, The Fix, The Pot, those kind of songs. They're just fantastic. But these records you guys made, Grease Grease and Babylon, and then later the Gumbo record, they have a really interesting mix of sounds to them.
Yeah. Well, that was a mixture of New Orleans and Los Angeles.
Right, yeah.
That's the difference is when I was making those things in New Orleans, I had all New Orleans people, and we did, you know, I did all kinds of stuff with that.
Yeah.
But when the Dr. John thing came up, only because I had, me and Sonny and I had a deal with Atlantic Records to produce some things other than Sonny and Cher. And Sonny brought me two or three acts for me to produce. But I didn't think much of them, but if you wanted them, I did them. But then I found out those were sent to Atlantic and Harold Baptiste Productions. The chick up at Atlantic was telling me that they were sending those productions as Harold Baptiste. Well, I didn't like that. And I began to think, well, I had fooled around with this long enough to know that I should be treated better than that. He had managers, Joe DeCall and them cats. And they had tried to start the record. This was a production deal without meaning, you know. It was just between him and, so I said, well, if they're going to send something in my name, I'm going to do something that I want to do. And that's when I asked Mac. I said, man, is there anything you'd like to try to do? And I said, I got out, you know, I'm supposed to be able to do this, so I'm going to do this. And so he told me about this. He'd been reading about this cat, Dr. John. And he was going to do it and let Ronnie be Dr. John. We were just going to produce it. But when Ronnie's manager figured out what it was, he said, no, Ronnie's too good a singer for that. And so I thought, I met Max Simmons, you know, singer, you could do this. Oh, man, I can't sing. No, I can't. I said, well, you don't have to sing. You don't have to sing for that shit. Just be Max, that's all. And then I went around and I got to put together all the New Orleans people that I could find in Los Angeles. You know, Jesse Hill and Shine and Tammy Lynn and Shirley Goodman and all the people out there in Los Angeles. So we're going to do this thing with people who know what the feeling of this should be. And that's how that happened.
Yeah, those are just some fantastic records. We're kind of running out of time, so I need to move the story forward quickly. So excuse me, but you played with Graham Parson on his GP record, which is another sort of milestone record. You played with Tom Waits. You played with the Fifth Dimension. You even did some horn arrangements for the band The Plimsolls, kind of a...
Well, man, you find all that shit?
Actually, right. you don't use the S word if you could. I just researched it all. You worked on the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour on television. You worked with Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis on tour with them. Finally, you moved back to New Orleans and started teaching, started the AFO Foundation. And it sounds like you're a busy guy getting in. Just being interviewed seems to be a full-time job. I know you're busy.
And people don't pay me for that.
No, they don't. Well, they don't pay me to do my side of it either, so.
Well, you're doing it because you love it.
That's true. I guess that's why you do it. So in the end, how does it all feel? I mean, obviously you learned a bunch of lessons. Are you an angry guy? Are you a happy guy? You've always got
I'm not happy. I'm really not happy. It's not because of money, but the stuff that I've had to go through, my main job, goal always was about my family.
Mm-hmm.
I have four kids, and they're suffering, not really suffering, but they're less than they could have been had I been more astute about the kind of money I should have made.
Yeah,
that's the thing that has me sad at this part of life. Of the anger that's in me is because when I see them in New Orleans nowadays. They're putting Mac Rebernick as the guru of New Orleans music. Mm. And I said, wait a minute, man. I, the way I see Mac is a drug addict.
Are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, I mean, I see him once in a while, and, you know, but I can tell that he's not too comfortable around me.
Mm.
He's not too comfortable because, you know,
There's three great compilations of AFO music available. I think they're all on the Ace Records label, and there's lots and lots of great stuff on there, and I urge everyone to go there and to check that out. There's also some great new Harold Batiste music. You can find that at afofoundation.org. Is there more AFO stuff from the 60s that has not been released?
You know, the label in Ace Records out in London,
mm-hmm.
they did three CDs of a lot of those unreleased things that I had done back in the day.
Right, three CDs, and they're all fantastic.
Yeah, and I don't know what's going on with that, you know, but all that. See, that's the business has gotten away from me.
Mm.
Everything is overseas and a lot of this stuff. Yeah, I just don't understand. It's too cumbersome for me now.
Do you still own all that? All the rights, all that AFO stuff?
Yeah, but I'm supposed to. I don't know. You know.
Well, Harold Batiste, I've got what have I got? Old Wine queued up here from the AFO executives. You remember? Oh, yeah. Remember recording this track?
Sure. We used to play that on the gig, man.
Just a kind of a great little workout. Everybody gets a little piece here.
Yeah. We had a lot of fun with that tune, man.
Yeah. Well, any parting words before we all get to hear this?
When you put that together, would you send it to me?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send you a CD. I'll call you. I'll email or I'll call you and get your address. But I will. I'll talk to you later today. Okay.
Service me well, if you ain't gonna pay me.
You want money?
Huh?
You want money?
Sure. I need money.
Yeah, me neither. Harold Batiste, it's been a true pleasure talking with you today. It's a very, very interesting story.
All right.
And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
All